This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, welcome to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. For the last week of the year, we are revisiting some of the most inspiring conversations we've had on the show throughout the year. On this edition of Best of Good Things 2021, we'll be focusing on young people building a better Malaysia. Amir Abdul Hadi is one of the founding members of Liga Rakyat Demokratik and Parti Muda. When he joined us on the show, we had a chat about the Tangkap Najib protest that took place in 2015, in which Amir and his friends were bloodied and arrested, how punk rock music fueled his activism journey, and why he ultimately decided to start a political party. Here's a snippet from that conversation.
So after I graduated from university, I joined a youth collective called Kelab Bangsa Utama, KBU. Not sure if you have heard about it, but this is where I met with my good friends like Adam Adli, Mandeep Singh, Rahmat Arun, Pak Wan, and also Ishamuddin Rais. Kelab Bangsa Utama, or KBU, is a youth collective that gather young rebels. we have a collective house in Bangsa Utama, mm-hmm. and we organize a lot of events and activities like political lectures, forums, movie club, online radio. We also have free tuition for the poor and also soup kitchen called Dapur Jalanan Kuala Lumpur. I can say most of the protests that's happening in Malaysia at that time, mm-hmm. before GE14, started in KBU. We will have our discussion there. Even Bersih meeting, some of the Bersih meeting, we have it there. So in 2015, if you remember, we are going through a political crisis. At that time, opposition coalition broke up, Pakatan Rakyat.
Yes.
PAS left Pakatan Rakyat, that left opposition in shambles. At that time, more than 50 youth and student activists and friends from KBU, including me, myself, came together to discuss about the situation and how we can move forward. I still remember we had the first meeting at Chinese Assembly Hall. So we believe that having a strong opposition in parliament is important, at least as check and balance to the government. And this is where this is when Gerakan Anak Muda Demi Malaysia was born. And our very first demand at that time is that opposition must create a new strong coalition. We are not saying that the opposition coalition is formed because of us.
Of course.
But that's how we form our organisation.
Right.
And Demi Malaysia, Gerakan Anak Muda Demi Malaysia, or Demi Malaysia, later changed its name to Liga Rakyat Demokratik with new objective at the time to amplify the voices of the youth in politics. So we have organised rallies, including Tangkap Najib. A year later, Tangkap MO1. The first ever youth congress in 2017. We managed to gather youth from all across the country, and we even endorsed few of our members contesting under Pakatan Harapan banner in GE14. After trying for 2 years, the Registrar of Society at last approved our registration in January 2020. And during the MCO, together with few other NGOs, we managed to provide food aid for more than 50,000 families across Malaysia. So that's how we form Liga Rakyat Demokratik.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I also understand that you were part of Suara, which is Suara Rakyat Malaysia, which is one of the most important human rights agencies in the country. Where does your passion for activism stem from? Was there a particular moment, you know, growing up that inspired you to go down this path? Because you called yourself a rebel, right? In a positive way, of course. So how did you become this rebel?
There is a few reasons, actually. Maybe I can start with this. When I was in high school, mm-hmm. I was in a band, a music band, playing alternative rock music, or some people call it punk rock music. This is what many people do not know about this kind of music, because it often comes with a very critical, political, anti-establishment messages in their lyrics. Few bands that influenced me a lot, like Anti-Flag, Rise Against, The Clash, they are very critical towards the society, the government, the politician, of course, talking about a lot of issues, corruption, inequality, of racism, like you mentioned, oppression, war, and so on, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Listening to this kind of music actually developed my critical thinking. I started to question almost everything. I started to even question about my own existence. So this is I think one of the factors. And another is because I grew up in Balakong, in a middle low income family. My parents are both from Perak, and they moved to KL and then to Balakong, looking for a better opportunity. Most of the people here is from the same background, almost. People from outside of KL or Selangor moved to this area, and of course, at that time, the housing here is cheap, maybe cheaper than now. And we struggle. We really struggle to survive. I still remember there's one story. At that time, we can't even afford KFC. We are not tempted looking at KFC ads on TV or newspaper.
Right.
And because we cannot afford it, my mom would buy instant flour to fried chicken, and that is enough to make us happy. It feels like you're eating KFC. Even that is actually quite rare at that time. Most of the time, we'll just eat rice, fried egg, and soy sauce. First music, and then the situation. And then my friends, many of my friends, I can say many of them, involved in drugs and gangsterism.
Okay.
I grew up with them, going to the same school, hanging out at the same place. I see with my own eyes how some of them either end up in jails or falling into addiction of drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
This is also makes me question, why is this happening? If we have the strictest drug-related laws, why we still have it here? Isn't it because of corruption? I've always been told that our country is rich, but why is there still a lot of people living in poor condition? What happened to our social security system? Mm-hmm. Incompetent government, and why there's so much hate, racism, because that's how politicians can stay in power using race and religion, and like I mentioned, the band that I mentioned earlier, Rise Against the Flag, they don't just sing, they are also involved in political activism. They really go to the ground, working with the community, protesting about various issues. So I kind of follow them. Like, I don't just sing. At first, of course, I pour all of my dissatisfaction in my lyrics. And then I started to join political action. And when I managed to go to university, I started to get involved with student activism. And one more thing, I think it's also important, another factor, is because I think I'm a bit lucky because my parents are quite political themselves. So they don't have any problems of me getting involved in political activism to attend or to even organize rallies and getting arrested.
People often talk about how fearless activists are, especially those who stand on the front lines like yourself, like your friends, you know, take on the government, take on the premier of a country. You have the courage to do what many of us can't. But when you're there on the ground, is it scary?
I have to be very honest. It's kind of scary, of course. Of course, you will feel, you will be afraid at first. But what's going to drive you forward is the agenda, is the idea that you wanted to push forward. And because you've read a lot, because you know that your country, the people in Malaysia deserve better, you know. So even though we are quite afraid at that time, even until today, I think if we organize rallies, there's a lot of things that we have to think about. It's different, you know. It's different for people who just attending rally and people who organize rallies. If you organize rallies, you have to think about a lot of things. The safety of the people who attended the rally, kids that might even attended the rally. And when are you going to be arrested? And we know after a few Bersih rallies, the government have kind of changed their tactics in dealing with protesters. They are not going to arrest you the day of the protest. They will arrest you after that. And of course, I lose count how many times I've been called to the police station to give statement. I think I've even make friend with the police because they know already, right? I can just like go to the some floor of the IPD and just hang out with them. And they even help me, you know, when the MCO started, and because we wanted to do food aid, they are the one that helping me to ensure that all the documentation is there. I used to believe that the police are all bad. But when I got arrested during Tangkap Najib rally, when they pushed me into the Black Maria, we call it the Black Maria, and then the police inside of the Black Maria showed thumbs up to me, you know, even though they are quite violent when they arrest me. But the police inside the truck showed thumbs up. And then when we were brought to the KL police station, some of the police even came to us, you know, because of course there is a few police person who scold us and everything. And then there's a few police who met with me when I went to the toilet. They said that, congratulations, how many people attending the protest, because they are also tired.
Yeah.
So I think at that time, it's kind of like changed my perception, at least towards them. So I don't really mind. I know they are just doing their job.
Yeah.
But I'm just hoping that they do their job properly and they can at least do the right thing.
That was a snippet of the episode titled Amir Abdul Hadi, Activist, Politician, Rebel. Kira Yusri and Tharma Pillay are two individuals who started the movement to lower the voting age in Malaysia from 21 to 18. They're co-founders of the youth advocacy group Undi 18 and were chosen by Forbes earlier this year for its annual 30 Under 30 Asia list. Here's a clip from that conversation. Let's turn back time to 2016. How did it all start? I mean, you guys were in the US right at the time. Did you guys already know each other? How did this idea come about?
So yes, we knew each other through student organizations in the US. Tharma was the student president of his regional student organization called the East Coast Presidential Council, and I was the student president for the Midwest Council. So if you know how like a Malaysian student in America work, we have three regions broken down, essentially managed by the Malaysian embassy. So then each of these regions, we have our own student organization because we were just too big, you know, so you do need sort of some form of centralization in terms of like coordination. Anyway, we eventually joined a group called the Malaysian Students Global Alliance, which at that time had about almost 20 member councils of Malaysian students around the world. So this was very significant because it helped us build, you know, it gave us access to like a coalition of student leaders that were representative of their peers and their community in the specific countries. So we had Malaysian students from studying in Malaysia, we had Malaysian students studying in Indonesia, in Hong Kong, in the UK, US, Australia, even Egypt and China as well, you know, because we have Malaysian students all around the world.
Right.
And interestingly, at that time also, you know, as Malaysian students living in the US, it was also the US presidential elections. And that was the year that Donald Trump became president. So I think personally for me, it was a very transformative experience in terms of my political awakening, because I was not politically active, you know, growing up as a teenager or as a child. My parents voted, right? And they talked about voting, but they would just, you know, they just do it, but they don't really, we don't talk about politics at home. And being on campus as a Malaysian, as an international student, and then you see so much of political discourse happening, it was very bizarre for me. You know, like in the US, right, we have college Democrats, college Republicans who are official associations.
Wow.
And they would debate it out in the cafeteria, and they were just arguing about immigration policies, which affected people like me, international students. They were debating about economic policies, TPPA, you know, which Malaysia was involved in. So it was so interesting. And even politicians were actively campaigning on campus. Like Bernie Sanders came to my university. I was like, you know, like, wow, like, you know, I've never met a Malaysian politician before that. And then, you know, you have a US presidential candidate coming to universities, trying to engage young people. And I had classmates who were 18, 19 years old, who have already voted at local council or local government levels, right? Meaning they understand the importance of casting a vote. They understand the importance of democracy and participation. So I think that was a little bit of like, you know, for us as Malaysian student leaders at the time, we were thinking, why don't we see this kind of political discourse in Malaysia? Why don't we see this kind of appreciation of democratic processes in Malaysia? So that was, you know, one of the inspirations behind Undi 18, I would say. We figured that, you know, let's start by talking about how Malaysia was one of the very few countries, I think less than 10 maybe countries in the world, that still had our voting age at 21 and above. Yeah.
So now you guys are public figures. Your Twitter following, your social media following is growing. Politicians are always keeping tabs on what you guys are saying, your achievements, what you guys are pushing for. I guess being a public figure, with it comes its fair shares of downside, right? I guess the downside is some of the criticisms that y'all will be constantly facing. And one of the criticisms I've seen being thrown at y'all, especially on social media, is that you guys come from privileged families, and you know, I mean, y'all went to the US to study. So what will y'all, or what do y'all even know about what the common Malaysians are going through? How would you respond to these kinds of criticisms? How do you take it in without being, without it dampening your spirits to keep, you know, pushing forward?
I think for me, the simplest reality is that when I look at my own background, I am from a B40 background, right? My mom is a single parent. My uncle is a lorry driver, right? So these are the kind of experiences that I face. And the only reason why I managed to go to the US and study was because I was on a government scholarship. So looking at the reality of my own life, to say that it is a movement by privileged individuals, the reality is that it's absolutely untrue, right? Looking at my own background. Mm-hmm. But I think the more important thing is that, why do people say these kind of things? Why do people throw those kind of accusations in a bit to delegitimize the movement? It's because they are not able to argue based on facts, and they are only using sentiment to counter these ideas and try to delegitimize the movement. And I think that's what advocates and activists need to sort of brace themselves when we face the crowd, right? Then there needs to be a certain level of patience, a certain level of acceptance that yes, there will be trolls, there will be people who will hurl unfair accusations against you, but you must rise above. You must come up with solid arguments. You must come up with the facts, right? For example, when we come up with data based on the Ministry of Education's educational blueprint, that only about 48% of Malaysians go to tertiary education. 52% of Malaysians stay and either work full-time immediately at 18, 19 years old, or they go into a short course and then they start working, or they already have a family, right? So these are the kind of realities of people around the country. So I think the idea is this: if people fight you with sentiment, you bring the argument, you bring the facts to shut them up. And I think most importantly is that to not be deterred, even when people are attacking you, because the reality is that, at least for me, right, I know that I am not from a privileged background, but even being from an underprivileged background, I believe that this is something that matters for all Malaysians. This will change the landscape of how we see young people, how we educate young people, and how we respect what young people are demanding for.
What about you, Kira?
I think so. I have a very different upbringing than Tharma, right? So I am very lucky that my parents managed to break out of poverty cycle when they were young themselves. So I went to the US on with my parents' support. But I grew up in Miri, Sarawak as well, because we moved there when I was younger. And my experience of seeing injustice and seeing inequality was through the work of my mother. My mother was a civil servant. She's a government school teacher, and she teaches pendidikan khas, or special children, right? Mm. And she was the only kindergarten teacher in Miri, in the town, where it's a city, actually. It's a city. And there's only one government kindergarten for special children, meaning that, you know, if you are unable to, before we moved to Miri, if you are below 7 years old and you want the education, you had to send your kids to private school or private centers if your kids were had disabilities. I saw my mom fought for her students' rights when growing up as a teenager. You know, she would march up and down to the district education office asking them, where are my students' allowances? Because if you're a person with disabilities, you qualify for allowance OKU. And her students were not getting the money on time. And if and when it comes to lower income communities, allowances are important, because if, you know, they rely on it every month to survive.
Right.
And my mom was like, you know, marching up and down. She faced racism, she faced sexism, she faced discrimination in the public sector, in the work that she does. And I felt like I am able to continue my studies. I am able to study the degree that I wanted in the university that I wanted. It was my obligation to give back to the community. I wanted to be a government teacher as well, to Teach for Malaysia, but I didn't meet certain criteria. So I ended up working for Teach for Malaysia as a staff member. And through there, I, again, worked with students from B40 communities. I went to schools. I observed how my peers were teaching in classrooms. And I realized that we need a disruption in the education system when it comes to civic engagement and civic education. So that became, so which is why, you know, after Dharma and I graduated from university, Undi 18 was something we threw our entire beings into, because we really believe that so many young people deserve to have their voices heard. They deserve to have a better education system. They deserve to have governments and politicians who actually listen to them. And that is why we still do the work that we do. The question about like privilege and all that, I think for Malaysians, I think as long as we acknowledge that we are all privileged to a certain extent, you know, and because of, you know, intersectionality and all that, as long I believe that, you know, if we acknowledge it, it's the first step of having the next conversation, right? So the conversation shouldn't stop at just dismissing someone based on your status, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're Malay or non-Malay, and about your socioeconomic class. The bigger question we should ask each other is that what are we doing to contribute towards a better society, a more progressive society, towards the Malaysia that we want to have eventually? So I think that is a conversation that is often only halfway, because we tend to dismiss people based on our identities.
That was a clip from the episode titled Undi 18, Forbes 30 Under 30 Asia, featuring Kira Yusri and Dharma Pillai. All right, we do need to go for a very quick break now. When we come back, we will continue reflecting on the best of good things in 2021. Keep it here on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan, and today we're having a listen to the best conversations we've had throughout the year with youth leaders who are fighting very hard for a better Malaysia. Ida Tien is the co-founder of Closing the Gap, a program to empower bright, deserving students to overcome the odds and enter ambitious universities. Ida has been an education activist for quite some time, working for Teach for Malaysia at one point, and is now also the deputy CEO of Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman, which powers Closing the Gap. Here's a little bit of what she had to say on the show.
I think in the early stages, I mentioned just now, we were trying to look into how to bring this program from the UK to Malaysia. Right. So one of the things that we knew off the bat was that you can't import wholesale a program into Malaysia where the context is very different. So for example, in the UK, with this, I would say majority, almost all of the students would go through the A-levels system after they're done with the O-levels. So in terms of the trajectory after A-levels, it becomes very consistent across the board, right? People go through A-levels, you apply through the UCAS system, and then you get into university through that way. But it's very different in Malaysia, where after Form 5, the options sort of branch out into multiple ways. And there are so many sort of options that are presented to you after Form 5. It can be really overwhelming. And so one of our challenges was, how do we then adapt that program to Malaysia, where it is not really true that all students go through a consistent sort of Form 6 experience together. So if, let's say, you go through Form 6, it's a good, I would say, 2 or 3 years before you even get to university, whereas if you take something like matriculacy or matriculation, it would be a good 1 year, and then you'll get into a university as well. And so I think when you have such uneven experiences between students, it was quite a challenge for us to think about, okay, we can't quite create like a clear-cut 2-year program, for example, for our scholars, because not every scholar, unfortunately, would actually get into university after 2 years. And so I think there's a reason also why, if you notice in some of our promotion as well of the Closing the Gap program, we usually say 2 to 3 years program, because it really depends the destination that, the pre-university program that our students get into, and then after that, subsequently, what's university that they go to, because unfortunately, the timelines do not match up. And so that was one of our biggest challenges at the beginning. But how do we figure out to contextualize this program so that it fits with the Malaysian needs? Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think one of the things that we found to be very key to the program was scholarships. So this was not something that is very evident in the programs in the UK. But we knew with our students, it's not enough to get students into university. You need to also help them fund the university's studies and fees. And so we started to explore whether financial literacy was something that was important for us to introduce, maybe not as like a core component of the program, but was definitely something supplementary that we had to do. And two was a huge emphasis on helping them apply for scholarships.
Right.
So especially if you want to get students to apply for private universities or overseas universities, it was very, very integral that they actually score a scholarship. And we have quite a number of students who have had considered not going for certain universities because they couldn't afford going there. So despite them securing an offer, for example. But I would say the earlier stages of, I would say maybe in terms of managing closing the gap, it was quite difficult. Because perhaps, I think even though there were four of us who started this, eventually it was me and Connie who actually ran it full time. So having a two-woman team running it was really fun. But there were, of course, a lot of challenges around resources. I mean, we knew that as we were recruiting more students, it was going to get more and more challenging. So, for example, as with the typical rules of a starting non-profit, it was always a concern about fundraising. It's always a concern about whether or not we have enough to expand the team, but at the same time, be able to offer a runway of more than, let's say, 6 months, right? We were lucky that we never got to a point where we ran out of cash. Although at the very beginning, we actually ran a lot of our programs sort of like with in-kind sponsorship and donations,
right,
so that we didn't really have to use or fundraise any funding. So the earlier stages of trying to find the footing around our resources to gain that stability so we can scale our program was a bit of a challenge.
Ida, what does education mean to you? Because, you know, we talk about education, and I think when it comes to, you know, wider society, even ourselves, you know, like we, you know, touched on a little bit earlier, this idea that, you know, when we were growing up, we were told you go to school, you get good grades and you're set for life. Obviously, you know, that's not the case. I'm wondering, what does education mean to you right now? And, you know, did working at Teach for Malaysia, a lot of people, even like when I interviewed Soon Singh, for example, he said working at Teach for Malaysia was one of those things where it really changed his perspective of education. Was it the same with you?
I think that's such a big but important question to ask, right? And I think I've always taken education, I think for most people, to take it for granted as this thing that you have to go through. And I think I've never really quite examined what it meant as well until some of the turning points in Teach for Malaysia, which also includes co-founding Closing the Gap.
Right.
And I think at the time, I was trying to figure out for myself, why is it so important for me that Closing the Gap happened, or why, of all things, that we focus on higher education especially. And I think it's a lot to do with how education is a way of satisfying choices and satisfying curiosity. And I look back at my own experience as well. Like, my parents were not university educated. My dad and my mom came from rural parts of Sarawak. And a lot of times my dad growing up has been very, very clear to me about how I have the choices to actually pursue the university wherever I want to be, and he'll be supportive of that. And I always took that for granted until I started Closing the Gap, and we realized when we speak to students as well in Teach for Malaysia that this is not the case for a lot of them. In many ways, to be able to do what you love is quite a privilege. To be able to think about what you want to do in the future is something that doesn't cross their minds. And I want to see education as a tool that that sort of frees them to allow to dream, and to also give them the tools to reach that dream. And I think in many ways, what is maybe sad, and I think some of the criticisms we've heard about the education experiences that many people go through, is that it's not that. Education is becoming a race to get the number of A's, which I guess some people may argue is a way, for example, to get scholarships, to go to university. But I guess that's also why there's now a growing sentiment and growing conversation about how representative grades should be in allocating resources to students, or to even get them to the aspirations or the ambition that they have, right? So that's one, right, about this idea of what does it mean to say that a student, like, what does it mean to have enough education to get choices? So I think that's something that we need to shift towards something that's a bit more holistic, that education, if it's about giving people choices, then we also need to have a more holistic or comprehensive way of assessing a student's ability and the student's fit to the sort of pathways that they want to get into. But I think beyond that as well, I think one of the things that education means to me as well is about satisfying curiosity. And I feel like a lot of the conversation on education, understandably, is about how do you get students to be employable? And that is a very important part of the conversation of how do we make sure that students have the right knowledge and skills so that they become contributing members of society. But I feel in Malaysia, sometimes it's a conversation that's lacking about what it means to be a contributing members of society. Must it, for example, be students only in STEM? Because STEM is where it goes with research, with innovation, right? For example, we don't actually put as much emphasis on courses such as philosophy or anthropology, which at the get-go or from first sight doesn't seem to yield as much immediate ROI in terms of salary returns or in terms of how much business or profit it brings to businesses or even how employable this person is, right? And I think that's a very narrow way of looking at the purpose of education. Because if you look at a lot of places, for example, in the UK or in Singapore, where education is also about satisfying a curiosity, it's about enlightenment, right? And this actually gives you the sort of soft skills, the sort of understanding that allows you to really think about how do you become contributing members of society beyond the financial sense, beyond the business or capital sense, and thinking about how do you improve our lives. And I think that we are still lacking that. And I feel the ultimate purpose of education is really that. Like, how do you get people to be curious about the problems around them and how to solve it, be it whether or not it's something that's immediately employable in the industry that we recognize now, or industries that have not been created, but also in your own spiritual way, your own mental way as well, of what it means to satisfy learning, satisfy curiosity, and the questions and wonders about life.
That was a clip from the episode titled Giving Students Equal Access to Social and Cultural Capital with guest Aida Tien. And lastly, Heidi Kwa. She's a refugee rights activist. Heidi joined me on the show a couple of months ago and shared her story on founding Refuge for the Refugee at the mere age of 18, its growth over the past decade, and her entanglement with the authorities. Here's a little bit from that conversation. You founded Refuge for the Refugees at the mere age of 18. Now, I'm sure you've heard, you know, this joke so many times, you know, this idea, you know, when I was 18, I was just skipping classes to play football and do that. But here you are doing, you know, insanely important things, thinking about doing really, really important things at the age of 18. What actually, you know, pushed you or prompted you to start this?
Yeah, so I think for me, it was understanding my privilege, right? And I say this not because I come from a wealthy family. I don't. I come from a very regular, average income family. But I think for me, right after, I mean, I grew up, you know, going to school and everything. And in secondary school, my closest circle of friends were debaters and public speakers. And I remember sitting around our school canteen and talking about current issues at about form four, form five, and just being so angry at the government and at, you know, NGOs or just people out there for not doing enough for the society that needs it, you know, that needs the support. And for me, I think it was then realizing that, like, hey, what's the point if I sit around and point my fingers? What am I doing with my access to education? What am I doing with my voice? What am I doing with my influence, you know, whatever little influence I had, right? And what can I do with this? So for me, it was just really understanding privilege, right? Because I grew up thinking that privilege really meant, you know, big houses, fancy cars, nice holidays, you know, being able to dine out often. But I guess, you know, being able to work with the refugee community, it made me really realize that privilege simply means a roof over my head, you know, not having to worry about when my next meal is, access to education, and having a voice and an influence, right? So with this understanding of privilege, then what am I doing about it? And this is why I guess I'm so passionate about it.
Why is this particular cause important to you, Heidi? Because, you know, when it comes to activism, there are various, you know, fields you can get into. You can go into women's rights, education. Yeah. Why specifically refugees? Why did you choose to go down this path?
I think for me, I mean, it started because I was volunteering at a refugee school right after secondary school, right? And I guess upon meeting the refugee community, I just couldn't comprehend how is it that kids who are just a couple of years younger than me did not have access to education nor any basic human rights in that sense. I mean, they came, they fled war and persecution. I mean, they have so much boldness and courage and brilliance, right? And they took this huge step only to be stuck in a country that did not allow them access to basic human rights. I don't know. I couldn't sit with that, I guess. And that's why I decided that, like, hey, this is something I need to work on. I mean, working with the refugee community, I've seen how driven and how determined they are. These kids, they show up, you know, and they pay 100% attention, you know, in school. They're hungry for education. And how is it that just because of their documentation status, they're not allowed to have access to education, or just they're not allowed to feel safe? And that is why I guess this course is so important to me. I guess, long story short, you know, I've always imagined that if that was me, if I was stuck in a foreign country, undocumented, how would I want to be treated? You know, and it's really unfair that you know, these kids lack such access to basic human rights just because they're undocumented, not by choice, yeah?
What were some of the early challenges you faced when setting up refuge for the refugees? Because, you know, it's one thing, you know, you're sitting with your friends, you know, you're reflecting on your privilege and you're thinking, okay, I have, you know, a little bit of influence. I have a little bit of privilege. I want to do something with it. What happened next? Like, and I'm wondering, like, once you decided, okay, this is the cause I want to champion, this is the line of activism I want to, you know, go into, what next, and what were some of the challenges you faced, especially very early on?
In the beginning, it was just so hard to even educate people on the plight of refugees. And we were constantly being questioned, you know, and told off for working with refugees instead of, you know, local Malaysians. Mm-hmm. A lot of times as well, you know, being young 18-year-olds, wide-eyed, excited, rose-tinted glasses, you know, just approaching people about a cause, a lot of times people felt that they couldn't buy into the vision and they thought maybe we were just a bunch of 18-year-olds, you know, that was just, you know, passionate for a short while. So I think it was just constantly needing to have conversations that were educational. The biggest challenge was honestly being young and also being female. I remember just constantly being outnumbered, right? And people wouldn't want to, you know, listen into a conversation with us just because we're young kids, you know, that apparently did not know what we're talking about.
You have grown, you know, slowly from just something that you thought of out of the blue and, you know, growing into this massive organization that it is right now. And what I really love about the organization is that it's not just a charity organization. Yes, yeah. There is, like, you know, food aid and all of these things as well, but it's also, yeah, you know, it's also about empowering the community. Talk to me, yeah, about how you and your organization pushes to empower the refugee communities, and why is this aspect of, you know, this empowerment, yeah, aspect important to you?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer that, you know, we're not here to, loosely put, help the community in that sense. We're here to work together with them, right?
Right.
And I think the biggest gaps in our system, I feel that sometimes is a lot of times organizations, and this includes us, you know, when we were a really new organization, a lot of times organizations kind of go to communities and go like, hey, this is what I think you need and this is what we should implement. A lot of times we don't take feedback, or we don't kind of include the refugee communities in designing solutions or programs that actually benefit them. We don't consult with the refugee communities despite them being people that we serve. And I think that has taken the biggest shift in the organization the past couple of years. Actually, we prioritize that now instead of, you know, discussing with other NGO partners or looking at international organizations, you know, for ideas or you know, how to run programs. We always tell people that the first thing that you do is to sit with the refugee community and go like, hey, what are your needs and what do you need from us, right? And how can we support you, and how can they take anchor in running these programs, and how can we support them? How do we not shove our vision and values down their throat in that sense, but how do we support them, and how do we give them that space to take lead? And that has been a lot of our stance in the past couple of years, right? Mm-hmm. How do we kind of give back the voice to the refugee community? Because honestly, I can be an activist, Dashrin, but I will never be able to fully advocate to be a good enough advocate for the refugee community, because I do not have that lived experience,
right?
But for the refugee community, right, how do we give them back to voice? How do we put them back in the driver's seat? And so now, you know, I make it a point that each and every time I get invited to a consultancy meeting or a speaking engagement or a panel or whatsoever, I go like, hey, can I bring, you know, like, for example, if it's a roundtable meeting, right, with, you know, government or stakeholders, I go like, okay, I'll only show up if I'm allowed to bring someone from a refugee community with me. And this person gets a seat at the table and space and time to talk because they probably have the most valuable addition.
That was a clip from the episode titled Heidi Kwa on Fighting For and Empowering Refugees. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. If you'd like to check out the full episodes from any of these shows highlighted, they are all available on podcasts. You can just find them on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Just have to search Good Things. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.